Welcome back to The Deep Dive, the place where we turn the day's dense, sprawling news into essential knowledge and high-impact insights. I'm Alex Vanderbilt.
And I'm Sam Aster. Today, we are undertaking a pretty massive synthesis. Our sources cover the entire spectrum of global volatility, moving from, you know, the most intricate political maneuverings and corporate financials all the way to geopolitical brinksmanship in multiple theaters.
Our focus today is a really comprehensive analysis of the Wall Street Journal for Friday, October 24th, 2025. So if you're looking for a shortcut to being fully informed on the most surprising, critical, and frankly complex stories shaping the world right now, you are definitely in the right place.
Absolutely. Our mission is to connect these seemingly disparate stories. We're going to start immediately where high-stakes politics collides with digital finance and global trade, looking at decisions made in Washington that are, well, already sending shockwaves through Wall Street and right across international borders.
Okay, let's unpack this right away, starting with the headline that truly merges political power and personal wealth. The presidential pardon of Changpeng Zhao, better known, of course, as CZ, the founder of the colossal crypto exchange Binance.
Right. And this pardon is far more than just a personal act of clemency. CZ pleaded guilty to an anti-money laundering violation, served, what was it, 4 months?
4 months, yeah. He got out in September 2024.
Right, September. So now the full pardon just wipes his record clean.
Right.
What's really critical here is the undeniable political and financial motivation driving this whole action.
Yeah, the sources make it pretty clear this move was strategically timed. It came after months of really visible efforts by Zhao and his associates to dramatically boost the Trump family's newly launched crypto venture, World Liberty Financial.
Mm-hmm.
And we should pause here, because this venture is apparently the engine behind the huge leap in the president's personal wealth reported over the last year.
Absolutely. Binance was basically the crucial accelerant for World Liberty's dollar-pegged cryptocurrency, USD1. They gave the company its first monumental break this past spring with a massive $2 billion investment.
$2 billion?
Yeah, paid entirely in USD1 from an outside party. So Binance essentially validated the currency, right, and provided the liquidity that USD1 desperately needed to be taken seriously in the market. Plus, they pushed trading of USD1 across all the platforms they control.
And this isn't just some arm's-length corporate transaction. It's personal, too.
Oh.
Zhao is apparently quite close friends with Zach Witkoff, one of World Liberty's co-founders.
Right. And Witkoff's father, Steve Witkoff, he's currently serving the administration as a special envoy.
So it paints this picture of a tight, almost perfectly circular relationship where, you know, political access seems to facilitate financial advantage, which in turn maybe fuels political campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
Quite something.
And the administration, through its surrogates, like White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt, they offered a specific justification. They're arguing that the prior administration's prosecution of Zhao was politically motivated.
Part of a war on cryptocurrency was the phrase used.
Exactly. And therefore, the pardon was just correcting an injustice. Trump, according to Leavitt, was sympathetic to this whole argument of political persecution.
But the implications here are massive, aren't they? Especially when you think about global financial integrity. The pardon essentially clears the path for Binance, the world's largest crypto exchange, to potentially make a full return to the U.S. market.
After it was effectively barred, yeah, following that 2023 guilty plea.
Exactly.
And this is where the precedent becomes truly profound, I think. The pardon will likely prematurely terminate the Justice Department's mandatory 3-year monitorship over Binance.
And that monitorship was key, wasn't it?
It was the key component of that record. $4.3 billion fine levied against the exchange for failing to police anti-money laundering violations. Violations so egregious, they basically allowed the platform to function as a colossal hub for illicit funds worldwide.
So that oversight wasn't just bureaucratic red tape. It was the U.S. government's ability to police an offshore entity on behalf of the entire global financial system.
Precisely. Removing that oversight early and citing political motivation for doing so sets a really dangerous precedent. It essentially suggests political influence can just void a critical financial crime oversight regime.
It really raises a fundamental question about control, doesn't it? Is financial compliance enforced by impartial regulators, or can it be overridden by, well, political favors?
And you can bet Democrats on Capitol Hill are already scrutinizing this whole relationship. They're arguing that the financial intertwining between Binance and the Trump family represents serious ethical concerns that demand investigation.
Okay, now let's pivot a bit from crypto compliance to physical trade, because the administration has also just completely torched trade negotiations with Canada, like overnight.
Yeah, this termination happened abruptly late Thursday. And the catalyst was, well, frankly, bizarre. A political advertisement sponsored by the Ontario provincial government.
An ad.
President Trump called it egregious and fake and instantly just walked away from the negotiating table.
So what was in this ad that caused such a reaction?
Its provocation lay in the content. It featured the actual voice of former President Ronald Reagan.
Reagan, wow.
Yeah, speaking passionately against protectionism. Reagan, an audio lifted from a 1987 radio address, said trade barriers hurt every American worker and consumer and inevitably lead to fierce trade wars.
The irony there is just incredibly thick.
Yeah.
A foreign government using a voice revered by the conservative movement to directly critique the protectionist policies of the current U.S. president.
Right. And the sitting president even went so far as to claim the audio was fraudulently used and designed to interfere with the U.S. Supreme Court, which is currently weighing the legality of his expansive tariff authorities. It's quite a claim.
But the consequences are immediate and practical. The two nations were deep in discussions about reducing those 50% tariffs Trump imposed on Canadian aluminum and steel.
Yeah, those were major sticking points.
And furthermore, they were set to immediately begin the renegotiation of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the USMCA. That is all instantly halted, off the table.
This move just highlights the radical philosophical shift within the Republican Party on trade. We've moved decisively away from the free trade principles championed by figures like Reagan towards, well, pure economic nationalism.
And that fundamentally changes the economic landscape for global supply chains, doesn't it? Companies have relied on the stability of the USMCA structure for decades.
Absolutely. And north of the border, the pressure is mounting, too. Ontario Premier Doug Ford has been really vocal, pushing the Canadian federal government to take a more aggressive stance.
He's pointing to job losses, right?
Specifically, yeah. The catastrophic loss of auto sector jobs as major global players like Stellantis and GM pull back or shutter plants in the province. And he's attributing that, at least partially, to the volatility and cost created by Trump's tariffs.
And then you have Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick apparently throwing kerosene on the fire.
He is. He's floating the idea of completely dismantling the USMCA trilateral pact and breaking it down into two separate bilateral agreements.
Wow.
That signals the administration is fully prepared to destabilize the entire continental trade structure if they don't get the deal they want from Ottawa. It's serious hardball.
And while trade talks are collapsing with Canada, the U.S. is simultaneously reviving old trade irritants with Beijing. This seems like interesting timing.
Very interesting timing. It sets the stage for significant tension just days before a crucial diplomatic summit.
That's the one scheduled for October 30th in South Korea between President Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping.
That's the one. Yet, the U.S. Trade Representative is preparing to launch a new high-profile investigation under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974.
Okay, Section 301. Just remind us. That's the legal tool the U.S. uses to enforce its trade agreements, challenge unfair foreign practices.
Exactly. It's the mechanism that allows the government to impose sweeping tariffs and duties. And this specific probe will focus on China's compliance, or what Washington claims is a profound lack thereof, with the Phase One trade deal signed way back in 2020.
And the core issue is?
The core issue, according to Washington, is that China has simply not upheld its commitments, particularly in shifting its purchases of high-value agricultural goods like soybeans and other commodities away from the U.S. They haven't bought what they promised.
Now, Beijing has a counterargument, right? Something about the pandemic.
They do. They have a ready-made defense, arguing that the COVID-19 pandemic, which swept the globe just months after the Phase One deal was signed, made many of the volume commitments impossible to uphold due to, you know, logistical chaos and internal economic disruption.
But regardless of who's to blame, launching this new inquiry now, just days before the leaders meet, that seems like a textbook leverage play.
Oh, absolutely. Such investigations typically take many months, so immediate tariffs aren't really the primary goal here. The U.S. side clearly wants to demonstrate to Xi Jinping that non-compliance will not be tolerated and that the administration is prepared to act decisively if these Phase One failures aren't addressed.
So it definitely raises the temperature significantly ahead of that critical meeting.
No doubt about it.
Okay, moving from the complex world of trade disputes to the physical battlegrounds of global security. We are seeing heightened geopolitical pressure across multiple fronts, starting with a pretty significant economic strike against Russia's core lifeline.
Yeah, we're talking about significant new U.S. sanctions targeting Russia's two largest oil producers, Rosneft and Lukoil. Together, these two giants produce roughly half of Russia's entire oil output.
And this action marks a crucial turning point, doesn't it? Because it aligns U.S. and European pressure on Moscow for the first time since the start of the current administration.
That's right. Previous U.S. sanctions had conspicuously avoided these two giants, focusing only on smaller players. Now, all four major Russian oil companies, Rosneft, Lukoil, Gazpromneft, and Sergeyenergonaftgaz, are effectively blacklisted.
How did Putin react?
Well, President Putin acknowledged the severity of the action. He denounced the measures as an unfriendly act and confirmed they are serious and could have real consequences for Russia. Though, predictably, he downplayed the potential impact on ordinary citizens.
But that level of acknowledgement itself suggests these sanctions hit much closer to the economic core than previous rounds did.
I think that's fair to say. And the global market reacted instantly, confirming the seriousness. Oil prices surged, with Brent crude jumping 5% to settle around $65.99 barrel. That's driven by fundamental worries about global supply disruption.
But the long-term effectiveness of the sanctions hinges on enforcement, right? And critically, the reaction of the two countries that are essentially keeping Russia's economy afloat, India and China.
Absolutely critical. These nations buy roughly 5 out of every 6 barrels of Russian crude exports, often, it should be said, at steep sanctions-induced discounts.
So this presents a massive dilemma for both Beijing and Delhi.
Huge. If their major state-owned banks, insurance companies, or industrial conglomerates transact with sanctioned Russian entities, they risk losing access to the U.S. financial market and, crucially, access to the U.S. dollar payment system.
Which, as we said before, remains the global standard.
Exactly. And we're already seeing friction. Sources are reporting that Chinese state-owned oil companies have actually suspended purchases of Russian seaborne oil, fearing these secondary sanctions.
But not all Chinese refiners.
No. The independent teapot refiners in China, who often operate outside the dollar system and pay in yuan or other currencies, they may well continue buying.
And India. They're in a tough spot, too.
An extremely tough spot. They have been hoping for improved relations with the U.S., but the Trump administration already imposed a 50% tariff on Indian goods back in August, specifically citing its continued purchases of Russian oil. The pressure is explicitly linked.
Okay, shifting our gaze now from economic warfare in Europe to the physical war on terror in the Middle East, specifically the highly concerning resurgence of the Islamic State in Syria. 6 years after the official collapse of their physical empire, ISIS seems to be rising again.
Yeah, and the primary enabling factor seems pretty clear. It's the diminished American presence. Since April, the U.S. has pulled out about 500 of the roughly 2,000 American troops previously stationed in Syria. They've shut down multiple forward operating bases.
And the SDF commanders on the ground, the ones actually doing the fighting, they feel this absence profoundly.
They really do. In the past, you had Americans conducting daily joint patrols. These serve two critical purposes: deterring ISIS fighters directly, and just as important, reassuring the local population that their security was guaranteed. Now, those areas are, well, emptier, and the absence has been immediately exploited.
How is ISIS adapting its tactics?
They're operating as a decentralized mobile insurgency, relying heavily on small sleeper cells for ambushes, targeted assassinations, and devastating IEDs. And the statistics are frankly horrifying.
How bad?
Militants staged 117 attacks in northeast Syria through the end of August. That significantly outpaces the 73 attacks recorded in the entirety of 2024. SDF commanders confirmed that May was the deadliest month for their forces since 2019.
Wow. And it's not just attacks, there's an economic component too.
That's crucial. This resurgence is rooted in classic power vacuum tactics, not just kinetic attacks, but economic terror and extortion. ISIS is actively demanding zakat, the Islamic tithe, from local people in Sunni-dominated towns like Diban.
Using intimidation.
Absolutely. We heard specific anecdotes detailing how this works. Oil investors, for example, being targeted. One investor was threatened after refusing to pay $1,000. And later, one of his workers was tragically killed in a related shooting incident.
That's chilling.
It's the classic strategy. Fill a security void with intimidation, assert control over local economies, and generate revenue through fear. It is arguably a predictable consequence of the U.S. foreign policy shift towards a more isolationist stance.
Okay, let's move to another high-pressure zone. The U.S. is signaling, quote, seriousness and intent with a significant show of military force near Venezuela.
Yeah, that show of force involved flying B-1 Lancer bombers, heavy strategic aircraft near Venezuela. Importantly, they strictly maintained international airspace.
But the B-1 itself is a Signal.
Oh, definitely. It can fly supersonically and carry a massive payload, 75,000 pounds of bombs, more than any other U.S. bomber. Sending B-1s sends a message.
And this isn't happening in isolation, right? It's a part of a broader military buildup.
It's much broader. It now includes 8 warships, MQ-9 Reaper drones, and even F-35 fighters in the region. The stated purpose of this whole campaign is targeting alleged drug traffickers operating out of Venezuela and Colombia.
Have there been actual strikes?
Yes. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth confirmed the scope, noting that the U.S. has carried out at least 7 kinetic strikes on speedboats and even a submersible vessel in the Caribbean just since September.
But the real tension point seems to be the suggestion that the action might move on to land.
Exactly. President Trump has publicly suggested that striking targets on land could come next, focusing on major narcotics distribution or production facilities within Venezuela.
And that's raising concerns.
Big concerns. This specific suggestion has spurred growing bipartisan scrutiny on Capitol Hill over the legal basis for such strikes. Even though Congress has so far rejected measures to limit the president's power in these attacks, striking targets on the sovereign land of a hostile nation like Venezuela escalates the situation dramatically. It raises profound constitutional questions about presidential war powers.
Okay, finally in this segment, back to the Middle East. We are seeing an intense level of high-level U.S. involvement in Israel and Gaza. The Israeli media has jokingly dubbed it babysitting.
Yeah, babysitting Prime Minister Netanyahu. It's a literal revolving door of senior U.S. officials, Vice President Vance, Senators Rubio and Witkoff, former presidential advisor Jared Kushner, all descending on Israel.
And the goal is just keep the truce alive.
Their singular goal seems to be using high-pressure diplomacy to ensure the fragile Gaza truce remains intact. David Shanker, a former State Department official, noted that the complexity of the truce requires constant, minute-by-minute administration attention. It's incredibly fragile.
And they're walking a political tightrope, too, right? There was that incident with the West Bank annexation vote.
Yes, highlighted when VP J.D. Vance delivered a very rare and direct public rebuke of a largely symbolic vote by Israel's parliament to annex Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Vance called the move stupid and insulting.
Strong words.
Very strong. He reminded them that President Trump had personally promised Arab partners that this won't happen. That public chastisement really underscores the difficulty of maintaining regional support for the post-war Gaza plan while managing Israeli domestic politics.
And Vance also gave more details on that post-war plan, the one floated by Kushner.
He did. The idea is to effectively divide Gaza into 2 halves until Hamas is completely eradicated. And the key policy detail is that reconstruction funds, the cash needed to rebuild the devastated strip, would flow only into the Israeli-controlled part.
With the immediate goal being?
Rebuilding Rafah over the next 2 to 3 years for 500,000 displaced people.
How are Arab governments reacting to this division plan?
Predictably, they're fiercely opposing it. They fear it's a step toward permanent Israeli control and will ultimately lead to the expulsion of more Palestinians from the territory.
And compounding this problem is Hamas itself.
Right. In the 2 weeks since the truce began, the group is aggressively pressing for a post-war governance role in negotiations. They're directly resisting the Trump administration's demand that the group give up power in any form.
So they're not just fading away?
Far from it. Hamas is asserting its power through coordinated skirmishes and, alarmingly, a bloody campaign against rival Palestinian groups within Gaza. They're demonstrating to the population and the world that they remain the ultimate power capable of ruling the Gaza Strip, despite everything.
Okay, that transition from intense geopolitical conflict brings us back home to the domestic economy. And here we're seeing this persistent tension. On one hand, you know, the public mood is generally sour. But on the other, the financial data reveals some surprising and critical strength.
Yeah, that sour mood is definitely being soothed somewhat by surprisingly strong corporate earnings. These reports are providing absolutely crucial support to markets, especially since the government shutdown has essentially cut off the normal flow of timely economic data from government agencies.
So earnings reports are the main signal right now.
They're serving as the key source of investor confidence, absolutely. And the market reacted positively. The S&P 500, for instance, added 0.6% and is sitting just shy of a record high.
And this performance is grounded in fundamentals.
It seems so. 86% of the 130 S&P 500 companies that have reported so far have actually topped analyst estimates. We saw specific massive wins from companies like Dow, stock up 13%, General Motors up 15% after raising its full-year guidance. Las Vegas Sands also saw shares jump 12%, pretty broad strength.
But the most compelling corporate story might be the phenomenal turnaround at Intel.
Oh, absolutely. They reported net income of $4.1 billion for the third quarter, which is just a massive reversal from the $16.6 billion loss they incurred just 1 year ago.
$16 billion loss to $4 billion profit. That's huge.
It's incredible. Driven by aggressive cost shrinking and significant sales growth in their core PC processor line, it officially ended the longest losing streak the company has seen in 35 years.
And that momentum was solidified by a couple of major strategic moves, right?
Yeah.
Government investment.
Yes. First, the U.S. government announced back in August that it would convert $9 billion in federal grants into a 10% equity stake in the company. That signaled a massive vote of confidence from Washington.
And then NVIDIA got involved.
Then in September, the chip titan NVIDIA made a massive $5 billion investment in Intel and, crucially, committed for the first time ever to purchasing Intel's x86 CPUs for use in its high-margin data center servers.
That commitment is huge, isn't it? Given the competition in data centers.
It's massive. x86 chips have historically struggled to compete against ARM architecture in the data center space, so NVIDIA's decision serves as a huge market-defining validation. It signals Intel is back in the high-end competition against rivals like AMD, a real coup for them.
Now, let's look at the automakers. Starting with Ford, they doubled their profit.
Yeah, doubled profit to $2.4 billion, easily beating analyst estimates. This was fueled by strong pickup in SUV sales in Q3, pushing revenue over $50 billion. And CEO Jim Farley even specifically thanked the administration for expanding tariff relief on certain imported auto parts.
Acknowledging the direct economic benefit of those policies.
Explicitly. But that's the good news. There's a severe shadow looming in their supply chain.
The fire.
The major fire at Novelis, their key aluminum supplier in Oswego, New York. This disruption could potentially cost Ford as much as $2 billion in Q4 earnings, forcing them to immediately cut their full-year outlook. Novelis supplies about 40% of the sheet aluminum used across the entire automotive industry. It's a big deal.
But there was an update on that fire, a slightly better outlook.
There is a silver lining update, thankfully. Novelis initially expected the plant to be completely offline until early 2026, which would have been catastrophic.
Yeah.
However, their CEO now expects repair work to be completed much faster, aiming to be back up and running by the end of December this year. That accelerated timeline is a huge relief for Ford and the entire automotive supply chain.
Okay. Meanwhile, in the EV sector, Rivian is sending a maybe more worrying signal.
Yeah. The EV maker is laying off over 600 people, about 4% of its workforce. They're saying it's specifically to conserve cash and profitably scale ahead of their important R2 midsize SUV launch.
So this reflects a broader trend.
It seems to reflect the broader easing of support and adoption momentum in the electric vehicle market. It's hitting manufacturers who are still cash flow negative particularly hard. The initial hype cycle might be cooling a bit.
So despite this sort of corporate anxiety in some sectors and the generalized sour sentiment we talked about, the consumer seems to remain resilient.
Incredibly resilient, looking at the data. Credit card data is showing incredibly robust spending and, somewhat paradoxically, easing delinquency rates.
Meaning fewer people are paying late.
Exactly. The portion of late payers is actually shrinking, which is counterintuitive given the mood. Spending across six of the largest card issuers rose 7.5% year over year in the third quarter, outpacing inflation.
And who is driving this spending?
Well, this touches on our thematic idea of control versus access. The strength of this spending is overwhelmingly driven by affluent consumers, those with strong credit scores. They account for roughly two-thirds of all accounts at major banks.
And the banks are adjusting their strategy accordingly.
Completely. Top issuers are focusing immense resources on premium cards, those with high annual fees, because these affluent customers spend nearly three times as much as those with lower fee products.
Like the Amex Platinum card fee going up.
Exactly. American Express raised the annual fee on its Platinum card to $895 this year, yet account openings have actually doubled since the revamp. People are willing to pay a premium fee for premium access and perks.
And lenders are getting more confident.
It seems so. We're even seeing major lenders like Synchrony Financial loosen their lending standards after tightening them severely last year. Why? Because fewer borrowers fell behind on payments than they expected. This lower than anticipated stress level is a leading indicator. It suggests genuine systemic confidence among issuers in the overall health and resilience of the, particularly the affluent U.S. consumer base.
Okay, finally, in the economy section, we have the fragile housing market, showing a small but, I guess, welcome lift.
A small lift, yeah. Existing home sales rose in September to a 7-month high, reaching a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 4.06 million. This rise was almost entirely aided by declining mortgage rates, which have gradually fallen after getting close to that 7% mark earlier this year.
But analysts are still cautious.
Very cautious. They point out the market remains prohibitively expensive for most buyers. The median existing home price is still up 2.1% from a year earlier.
So what needs to happen for a real recovery?
The consensus among market watchers is that the average 30-year fixed rate needs to drop definitively below 6%, ideally maybe even 5.5%, to spur a truly substantial surge in activity. Last week, it was still resting at 6.27%. So progress, but still a way to go.
Right. That economic gridlock finds its mirror image in our domestic policy conflicts, where the government shutdown has now entered a real crisis phase for hundreds of thousands of federal workers.
Yeah, lawmakers failed to provide a last-minute legislative reprieve for essential federal workers. We're talking air traffic controllers, border agents, many others. These critical employees are now set to miss their next scheduled paychecks as the shutdown enters its grueling fourth week.
And the strain is already impacting safety and logistics, particularly in aviation.
It is. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy issued a stern public warning that the strain on the aviation system would hit travelers directly. He actually said he can't guarantee that your flight is going to be on time.
That's not reassuring.
Not at all. Absenteeism and sick outs among air traffic controllers are already beginning to spread. It recalls the dangerous conditions that eventually forced the end of the last record-long shutdown back in 2019. History potentially repeating itself.
And politically, it's just total gridlock. Maximum leverage.
Completely. In the Senate, Republicans failed to advance a simple bill that would just pay all federal workers required to report during the lapse. They fell short of the 60 votes needed.
Why did Democrats oppose paying essential workers?
Well, Democrats largely opposed the measure, arguing that passing a standalone pay bill would actually remove the incentive for Republicans to end the shutdown altogether. Essentially, they felt it would let the GOP off the hook.
So they're sacrificing immediate relief for long-term political leverage.
That seems to be the calculation. Democrats are demanding the restoration of enhanced subsidies for Affordable Care Act health insurance before they agree to reopen the government. Meanwhile, Republicans are insisting Democrats must first pass a short-term GOP spending bill the House has already approved.
So each side is basically holding the essential workers' paychecks hostage to force unrelated policy wins.
That's pretty much the shape of it, a classic Washington standoff.
Okay, moving to immigration. We are seeing new forms of organized state resistance to aggressive federal enforcement actions. Tell us about Illinois.
Right. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker established the Illinois Accountability Commission. This is an independent board tasked entirely with documenting aggressive federal immigration enforcement actions by ICE agents.
Documenting things like
citing instances of masked agents, using unmarked cars, using automatic weapons to raid apartment buildings filled with families. Really aggressive tactics.
Does this commission have teeth? Can it do anything immediately?
Not immediately. The commission itself lacks the power of subpoena or the ability to directly charge anyone. But the strategic goal is clear: building a comprehensive public record. Pritzker explicitly stated this record will be crucial to pursue justice to its fullest extent when Democrats potentially regain legislative control, maybe in 2027.
So it's a strategy built entirely around delayed accountability, trying to gain control later via meticulous record keeping now?
Exactly. It's a long game.
Meanwhile, in San Francisco, there was a plan for a federal surge, but that's been put on hold.
Yes. President Trump put a hold on plans to send federal agents to San Francisco for a large enforcement surge. This apparently followed direct discussions with the city's moderate mayor, Daniel Lurie, and notably high-pressure phone calls from major Silicon Valley leaders.
Like who?
Including NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang and Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff. Pretty heavy hitters.
So the tech leaders intervened.
It seems so. Mayor Lurie confirmed he pushed back hard against what he called militarized immigration enforcement. Trump eventually agreed to hold the deployment, stating he would allow local law enforcement to give it a shot first, even while suggesting crime curb would be faster and easier with federal help.
So the intervention of powerful corporate leaders shows the depth of the resistance network facing the administration on this front.
It certainly suggests there are powerful forces pushing back behind the scenes.
Okay, finally, on the domestic front, the New York City mayoral race has managed to turn kindergarten education into an unexpected campaign flashpoint. How did that happen?
It's quite something. Former Mayor Eric Adams jumped into the race late, throwing his endorsement behind former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who is running as an independent. This is seen as a late-stage effort to defeat the current frontrunner, Democratic Socialist Assemblyman Zoran Mamdani.
And the hot-button issue Mamdani raised is gifted programs.
Yes, his proposal to eliminate kindergarten entry into the city's gifted and talented programs. Supporters argue the programs unfairly and prematurely segregate students by race and class, and they subject five-year-olds to singular high-stakes assessments that basically determine their entire educational track.
And New York is unusual in testing kids that young for these programs.
It is an outlier. Second or third grade is the national norm for entry into these kinds of programs. Critics of Mamdani's plan are highly alarmed, calling it a manifestation of a socialist ethos that goes against meritocracy.
And Cuomo seized on this.
Immediately. Calling the proposal a political stunt and arguing that eliminating opportunities for excellence doesn't help underserved kids. This debate perfectly encapsulates the larger conflict over whether public education should prioritize equal outcomes or competitive excellence, a real microcosm of a national debate.
Okay, let's shift gears one last time. Into the realms of culture, new technology, and critically, the integrity of professional sports, which seems to be under severe threat right now.
A very severe threat. We're talking about the massive NBA gambling and match-fixing scandal. This is a sweeping federal investigation that has now charged more than 30 people.
30 people?
Yeah, with illegal gambling, rigged poker games, and match-fixing schemes. This could potentially rank among the most damaging revelations in league history.
And this really throws the integrity of the league into question, doesn't it? Especially since the NBA only embraced the lucrative legalized gambling industry just 6 years ago.
Exactly. The timing couldn't be worse from their perspective. Two prominent figures charged were Portland Trail Blazers head coach Chauncey Billups and Miami Heat guard Kerry Rozier. Both have been placed on immediate leave.
What are the specifics of the scheme? How did it allegedly work?
Federal prosecutors confirmed the scheme was nationwide, backed by organized crime families, and centered on insider trading of information related to athlete performance and team strategy, specifically using prop bets.
Prop bets meaning?
Wagers placed on specific actions within a game, like a player's number of points or rebounds, rather than just the final score. Easier to manipulate, potentially.
And Billups' alleged involvement.
In the case of Chauncey Billups, known as Co-Conspirator 8 in the indictment, prosecutors allege he gave insider information about his team intending to tank a specific March 2023 game. Basically, throw the game.
How?
This advance notice allegedly allowed gamblers to profit about $100,000 because they knew the starting lineup, which featured players essentially designed to lose before that information was public. And the Blazers did lose that game by 28 points.
Wow. And Rozier.
Similarly, Terry Rozier is accused of telling people close to him that he planned to exit a 2023 game early due to a supposed minor injury. This move was allegedly designed to help gamblers hit the under on prop bets tied to his performance statistics. He wouldn't hit his expected numbers if he left early.
Billups is a Hall of Famer, Mr. Big Shot. His alleged involvement is huge.
It's an enormous betrayal of trust. It validates the deepest fears people had about athletes and coaches potentially monetizing their insider knowledge through this massive, newly legalized betting market, really damaging for the league's credibility.
Okay, moving to new technology. Hollywood is now placing big bets on a tiny format they call microdramas. What are these?
Right, these programs are basically custom-built for phone-addicted viewers with extremely short attention spans. A microdrama is essentially a 60 to 90-minute program, like a short movie, but it's strategically chopped into bite-sized 1 to 3 minute vertical episodes.
Vertical video like TikTok or Reels.
Exactly. The plot is generally fast-moving, and the content often leans toward the campy or racy. Very digestible.
And the appeal for studios is the cost.
Primarily, yes. The business model is highly appealing because the production costs are incredibly low, usually ranging from $100,000 to $250,000 for an entire season. Compare that to the millions required for a traditional glossy streaming show. It's a different scale altogether.
And this market is growing.
Rapidly. This vertical video market is currently estimated at $8 billion, largely driven by users in China, but forecasts project rapid global growth, potentially exceeding $25 billion worldwide by 2030.
So studios are jumping in?
Scrambling to enter the space. Former Miramax CEO Bill Block is launching Gamma Time. Fox Entertainment has acquired a stake in Ukraine-based Hollywater, which owns the popular platform MyDrama. Big players are getting involved.
And who's watching these? What's the audience?
The primary audience is surprisingly specific right now, women aged 30 to 60. With romance being the dominant genre, closely followed by mob stories and revenge fantasies.
And how do they make money? Is it ads?
Mostly a freemium model. The first few episodes hook the viewer for free, and then viewers pay via in-app purchases of virtual tokens or subscriptions to keep watching the highly addictive, quickly paced stories. It's built for binging and micropayments.
Okay. Finally, we end with a piece of news that is just purely about the delightful absurdity of consumer demand, involving a sudden frenzy over prehistoric lawn decorations.
Yes, this is great. Field Station. Dinosaurs, a New Jersey educational theme park that is shutting down, listed its entire collection of life-size animatronic dinosaurs for sale on Facebook Marketplace.
The bargain prices.
Absolute bargain discounts. Imagine trying to explain to your neighbors that the 39-foot T-Rex in your front yard is a bargain discount at $2,700.
Chuckles, okay.
The sale created an absolute roar of interest, naturally. People desperate to acquire the biggest lawn decoration on the block.
But there were logistical challenges, I assume.
Immense logistical challenges. While a 6.5-foot Velociraptor was relatively manageable, the larger pieces required specialized private shippers. One geologist who was interested quickly dismissed it as way too much effort.
So did anyone get their giant T-Rex?
Sadly for them, no. Ultimately, the park decided against selling the roaring, moving creatures individually after the deluge of inquiries became overwhelming. Instead, they reached a tentative deal to sell the entire collection of 31 animatronic creatures as a single lot.
As one big package.
Yeah, for $50,000. And the park's founder expressed surprisingly sentimental perspective, comparing the sale to people who are putting their pets up for adoption because they're moving into an apartment. He wants the entire collection to remain together in New Jersey.
So, disappointing for the individual buyers, hoping for that colossal Tyrannosaurus on their lawn, but maybe a fitting end for the dino collection.
A fitting, if slightly less fun, outcome.
Wow. We have covered an incredible amount of ground in this deep dive, Sam. Moving from, you know, a major crypto pardon that potentially undermines regulatory oversight, to trade wars instigated by a Reagan soundbite. All while tracking real-time instability from Russia to the NBA courts.
It's a lot, but what truly connects all these volatile sources, I think, from the corporate earnings reports to the geopolitical brinkmanship, is that constant tension we identified earlier, the trade-off between control and access.
You really do see it everywhere once you look for it. In private aviation, for instance, the sources detail how models are shifting away from traditional ownership, which gives you capital control over an asset, right?
Right.
To subscription models like VistaJet.
Right. As one executive noted, why tie capital into an underutilized jet? Modern finance demands access and agility without the burden of depreciation, maintenance, liability, access over ownership control.
And that fight for control is kinetic in geopolitics. Xi Jinping's relentless purges in China are designed entirely to centralize and consolidate his control over elite politics.
Absolutely. And conversely, the high-impact sanctions against Russia are meant to starve Moscow of the financial control necessary to sustain its war effort by limiting its access to global markets and finance.
And we even see this trade-off reflected right down to the consumer data we reviewed earlier. The spending reports showed delinquency rates easing, people carrying higher balances, even amid negative sentiment.
Yeah, consumers are strategically paying for immediate access to goods and services now, often via those high-fee premium credit cards we talked about, sometimes sacrificing future financial control, like being debt-free to maintain their current consumption levels. Access now, control later. Maybe.
Yeah, it really does seem like the ultimate trade-off in the 21st century economy. So this leaves us with a final provocative thought for you, the listener, to mull over.
When looking at the systems you rely on, your finances, your data, your business decisions, even just your daily life, what are you actively paying to gain control over? And what are you strategically paying just for the access?
And maybe more importantly, in this volatile economic and geopolitical landscape we've just discussed, which model is truly the more sustainable one for your future? Control or access?
It's a big question. Something to think about.
We'll leave that question hanging in the air. Thanks for joining us for the deep dive.
Until next time, keep digging deeper.